Tonight on Arena, Ryan Murphy's version of the Bill Clinton Monica Lewinsky story comes to the BBC, and Jimmy Bernstein on the 60th anniversary of West Side Story and growing up as Leonard Bernstein's daughter. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. On October the 18th, 1961, exactly 60 years ago yesterday, cinema audiences were treated to a musical, lyrical and choreographic spectacular, which according to many has never been matched. The film in question had been a huge hit on Broadway, and its arrival to cinema screens was one of the most anticipated events of that year. Even now, six decades on, it remains unrivalled.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay,
buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have though to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America.
America, from the motion picture soundtrack to West Side Story, the 1961 movie that scooped a total of 10 Oscars, including Best Picture. Music by Leonard Bernstein, words by Stephen Sondheim, choreography by Jerome Robbins. It's still, for many critics, the choice as the best musical of all time. On the film's 60th anniversary, I'm delighted to be joined by Jamie Bernstein, daughter of Leonard, and author of the book Famous Father Girl, to talk about her memories of that time and the impact of this great work. You were very wrong. Lovely to have you with us this evening, Jimmy. You were very young when it was a Broadway hit for sure. What age were you then, and what age were you when the film finally hit the screens?
Yes, it's true. Very nice to be with all of you over there in Ireland from here in New York City, which is where I was with my family when my father was writing West Side Story all the way back in 1956 or thereabouts. I guess it opened in 1957. So I was just little. I was like 4 years old. And so I really have very vague, if any, memories of my father actually putting the show together. All I can remember is that his studio, which was off the front hall in our apartment, when the collaborators were in there working with him, Jerome Robbins and Steve Sondheim and the book writer Arthur Lawrence, all I could see was a giant haze of cigarette smoke. And I knew they were in there working. It was just this, you know, smelly cloud of gray fumes.
Yeah.
It was kind of horrible. But it was really the movie that made the show click for me, because by the time the film came out, I was about 10.
Yeah.
And then I was the right age to really appreciate it. And then I got very excited. I already had the recording, so my brother and I had worn out the grooves on the record, so we knew the score backwards and forwards. But when we finally saw the film, then it all really came together for us.
And I suppose, as you say, you were at an age then, 9 or 10, where maybe the subtleties of what was going on would speak more directly to you. How important was the Romeo and Juliet aspect of the story for you? Obviously, that's what it is. And West Side Story is a New York 1950s, 60s retelling of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
It certainly is. And I will tell you that I learned about West Side Story long before I learned about Romeo and Juliet, because, you know, who reads Romeo and Juliet when they're 4 or 5 or even 10 years old? So I came around to it backwards, working backwards from West Side Story.
And when you did get to Romeo and Juliet, just as a slight sidebar, how exciting was it then to say, oh, this is what my father has been working on, was working on all those years in the smoky room?
Exactly. Well, it was quite thrilling, and it was fun to see where the correspondences were. And, oh, I see that character is this character, and this is a reference to that thing. And so it made studying Romeo and Juliet lots more fun, of course.
I think it has done that for generations in all countries around the world, probably since its first inception as both a stage show and a musical. Let's go to the balcony scene, because I suppose this kind of transformation, the fact that we're on the fire escapes of these apartment blocks as opposed to a balcony in Verona, it really brings us slap bang into the centre of New York. And the action takes place in the alleyway. Maria, played by Natalie Wood, speaks to Tony, played by Richard Boehmer, on the fire escape, as I said, outside the family apartment window.
Shh. It is dangerous. If Bernardo knew...
We will let him know. I'm not one of them, Maria.
But you are not one of us. And I am not one of you.
To me, you're all the beautiful...
Maruca!
Sí, ya vengo, Papa.
Maruca?
His pet name for me.
I like him. And he will like me.
No. He's like Bernardo. Afraid. Imagine being afraid of you.
You see?
I see you.
Oh, Maria, see only me.
Richard Boehmer there as Tony, Natalie Wood as Maria in that balcony scene from West Side Story. Jamie Bernstein, daughter of Leonard Bernstein, with me on this Tuesday evening, commemorating and remembering the 60th anniversary of the film, 60 years old yesterday, in fact. You know, when you hear that, it's the classic Love Across the Divide, and I know this is as much about Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet as it is about West Side Story, but those words that we hear spoken there, the kind of the battle that is there between the two gangs, the Jets and the Sharks, that could be happening on the streets of New York this very day as much as it was happening 60 years ago, Jamie.
Absolutely. And this is the thing about both Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story. The themes that they take on are unfortunately so enduring. The theme of love struggling to rise above hate and prejudice and fear of the other and of the stranger and of the person in the other neighborhood, and all of that is in Shakespeare. And then in West Side Story, those authors added the elements of racism and immigration. And so what with one thing and the other, there is absolutely nothing dated about West Side Story. It could have come out today and we would all relate to it with complete freshness.
Although I believe, obviously, what we're talking about in West Side Story, Puerto Rican immigrants versus the Polish immigrants, that's the Jets and the Sharks, that's the battle that's going on here. Was the original...
It's not clear, actually. It's not clear about the Jets, because they are an amalgam. They're not just Polish. Tony is Polish, yes. That is his parents.
Yes.
But I think there's a mixture of Northern European white immigrants that comprise the Jets. So there's a little bit of everybody in there.
Yes, yeah. And I suppose it is that it's. I suppose in many ways it's white versus coloured is the real centre of the dynamic between the two communities.
It is in West Side Story, yes, and that's what makes it so extra relevant and tragic to this very day.
One of the things that really strikes me when you listen to it is, I want to go to Officer Krupke, Stephen Sondheim's lyrics here. Let's have a listen to a little bit. And one of the guys here is kind of, well, why am I so difficult? Why am I getting into trouble all the time? We'll come in on the second verse of the song and talk a little bit about it afterwards, Jimmy.
Dear, kindly judge your honor, my parents treat me rough with all their marijuana. They won't give me a puff. They didn't want to have me, but somehow I was had. Leap on lizards, that's why I'm so bad.
Wait, Officer Krupke, you're really a square. This boy don't need a judge, he needs an analyst care. It's just his neurosis that ought to be quite. He's psychologically disturbed.
I'm disturbed.
We're disturbed. We're disturbed. We're the most disturbed. Like we're psychologically disturbed.
A little clip there from Officer Krupke as we celebrate the 60th anniversary of West Side Story, with Leonard Bernstein's daughter Jamie joining us from New York this evening. I wanted to touch on that song in particular, Jamie, because it really gets to, I suppose, there's real social commentary within that song. It's great fun, and Sondheim is playing around with the lyrics, and the music is a great laugh with those big brass, you know, the trombones almost making laughing out loud at what's being said. It's a very serious theme, however.
It's a very serious theme, and it's actually a kind of brilliant illustration of the revolving door policies that in those days, and to a great degree still, just shunt around these troubled teenagers, you know, from one office to another in a big useless circle, and their actual issues are never properly addressed. And yet they did it all in this kind of almost vaudeville style, so full of hilarity. It's kind of brilliant, isn't it?
And it also, it speaks maybe to a side of your father's social conscience, I suppose. Obviously, Sondheim and the others who were involved as well were part of that statement. But I'm going to we're going to tweet a picture actually from your own book, Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein. And this is a picture from 1962. In fact, I'm sure you know the picture I'm speaking about. Your father is sitting at the podium. He's rehearsing the New York Philharmonic, I believe it is, and this is for one of his young people's concerts around the autumn of 1962. Do you remember much about that period, that particular picture, that moment?
Is this the picture where I'm sitting on the podium by his feet while he's rehearsing?
That's exactly it. Yes. And just if people want to look at the image, it's our Twitter handle is at RTE Arena if you want to see the image that Jamie Bernstein's speaking about now.
Yeah. And that is actually the cover of my book,
yes,
Famous Father Girl, which, by the way, was what my second grade classmate Lisa used to call me to tease me. Famous Father Girl. So I decided that was a fun title for the book. But in any case, I very much remember my father's young people's concerts. And they began in the same year that West Side Story came out on Broadway, because it was the same year he took over the New York Philharmonic. It was 1957-58, and I was just like 5 years old. And so those first young people's concerts were a little perplexing for me because I was awfully young, but I got the hang of them, and I went to all of them. So I have so many memories of those concerts and watching them being put together, because it all happened in one crazy day that they would get up at 5 a.m. and rehearse the orchestra and time everything and have the rehearsal and then the concert, and the whole thing happened in one big gulp. So it was very exciting to witness and be a part of.
Yeah, and I get what I was also interested in the aspect of this. To what extent do you think your father, that was part of the same social conscience that is present in a song like Officer Krupke? He wanted to open up the world of the music that he loved and adored. He wanted to open it up maybe to people and to young,
yes,
to kids who wouldn't get to hear it otherwise.
That's right. By his great invention was to put the New York Philharmonic's young people's concerts, which already had existed, to put them on television.
Yeah.
And that enabled everyone in the country to learn about music. And my father was this natural born teacher. Everything he did, in fact, was a kind of teaching. It was all the same act of reaching out and tugging you on the sleeve and saying, listen to this. I have to share this with you because I'm so excited about it. And he was just able to convey his own excitement. Mm. And that's what made him such a good teacher. And it was the same for him with issues having to do with social justice. He was a lifelong activist, and he felt he had to do everything he could to make the world a better place, having lived through a lot of moments when the world was not a very good place at all. So it was really his lifelong work, and he did it as often as he could through his own making of music, both by conducting and also through his compositions. And West Side Story is a prime example of a piece of music that is very much about trying to make the world a better place.
And what about the type of pressure, though, that, you know, being the daughter of Leonard Bernstein put on you? First of all, in terms of music, I'm sure having Leonard Bernstein in your front room can't have been a disadvantage when it came to learning things about music and given his teaching ability. But what effect did that have on you?
Well, the only disadvantage is that he could never turn off the teacher faucet. In fact, it was really more of a teacher fire hose in our family. And my sister's joke is that you had to be very careful about what question you asked our dad, because if it was too juicy a question, you'd be stuck there for an hour while he expounded on whatever the topic was that you had inquired about. So there was this sense of being kind of, you know, bulldozed by information, music, excitement, literature, everything that he was excited about. We were going to be brought into it ourselves. And I assure you, this was not a terrible problem to be having. It was a good problem.
A good problem. Let's listen. Let's go back to West Side Story. I want to listen to a clip here featuring Rita Moreno, but not Rita Moreno as Anita in the film. This is Rita Moreno quite recently, in fact. I believe she's 89 at this stage. And here she is speaking about West Side Story and what she remembers of it.
West Side Story is truly a unique film because it broke so many rules. It's really almost an American-style operetta. That's right away breaking a rule. Number two, it didn't have beautiful costumes. In fact, the gang boys really looked kind of ratty. Number three, it was a very, very serious film. It was indeed Romeo and Juliet set to music. There are scenes of violence. I mean, when did you ever see a Fred Astaire movie like that? This broke every single rule that I can think of with respect to movies and didn't have a major star. Natalie Wood was not a major star when this film came out. The star of this movie, and it gives me goosebumps to think of it because it's so rare, was the movie, was the property itself, the play. That was the star. And that's what makes all of this, when you think of West Side Story, such a phenomenal experience. And I thought possibly at the time that maybe there would be copycat movies. Not one. They wouldn't know where to start.
They wouldn't know where to start, says Rita Moreno. Jamie Bernstein, I know that the character of Anita, she's talking about the film being the star of the film, which of course is true, but she would say that. She is one of the major stars as Anita, the sister of Bernardo, the girlfriend of Bernardo. She is one of the major stars and a character that you absolutely adore.
It's true. And she got an Oscar for it too. Richly deserved. So I don't know if we're jumping the gun here, but I'm sure we're getting around to talking about the fact that there is about to be a new film of West Side Story. and Rita Moreno is in it. She's no longer playing Anita, but I don't know how much to tell and spoil things. I just want everybody to find out for themselves
what
when they go
doing.
To see the new film.
You've seen that because, I mean, so many people, this is a Spielberg version of it, of West Side Story. And so many people, what on earth would you go remaking West Side Story for? Were you wary about that?
Well, here's the thing about the original film of West Side Story. It is so deeply beloved by millions around the world. But, you know, there are things about it that are imperfect. My dad himself was not a big fan of that film for various reasons. But, for example, you know, the sharks and their girlfriends, the cast that played those parts were not necessarily Latinx.
Yeah.
And today that would be unacceptable. So that has been corrected in the new film. But that's just one of many things that are different about this version of the film. I've seen it. I got to see a screening, finally, a very, you know, socially distanced and careful COVID-related screening. But the movie is fabulous.
I can't wait
for everyone to see it. I really can't wait.
Well, that's a remake then that obviously has worked. What about the concert film, which had Kiri Takanaway as Maria and Jose Carreras featured in there as well? How did you feel about that recording and that that particular version of West Side Story?
Well, this is a film documentary that was made about the audio recording of West Side Story using primarily opera singers.
Yes.
So it was a very controversial idea because even some of the authors themselves were resistant to the idea that West Side Story could be considered operatic or was suitable for operatically trained voices. And my father wanted to prove the point that actually it works very well. So that's what this recording was. And then there was this marvelous documentary made by Humphrey Burton showing the process of the recording sessions. And it's a fascinating film. I think it's pretty easy to find. Maybe it's even on Netflix. I'm not sure. But it's out there. And it's really worth a look. Not only do you get to hear all that delicious music, but you also see these remarkable singers and you see all the dynamics between my father and the various singers.
Yeah,
and,
quite a dynamic between himself and Jose Carreras, it has to be said. Quite a lot of tension in the room, I would suggest.
Quite a lot of tension. Well, it was all pulled together in such a hurry that the casting of Jose Carreras was actually kind of a mistake. My father had somebody else in mind that he had heard on the radio, but he couldn't remember what the singer's name was, and everybody assumed it was Jose Carreras, but it wasn't. And the fact of the matter is, he's playing Tony, and he has a Spanish accent. So we already had a problem.
Hugely problematic, yes. I remember watching the documentary and feeling precisely that. That's a serious bit of miscasting. However, let us finish perhaps with something. I'm thinking of that final scene, you know, I don't know how many times I've seen it, and I don't know how many times still, when the hand of the body just drops down and one of the gang members comes in to lift it up and suddenly both gangs are united in this grief around the death. But I know that the moment that speaks really to you is, and the song that speaks most to you is Somewhere. Maybe you'd lead us in to that as we finish up, Jimmy.
Well, I love this song, Somewhere, so much. It contains everything about my father wanting to make the world a better place. You can hear it in the opening notes, that big upward reaching interval. There's a place for us. It's so reaching upward for that better world that he is so sure can be out there for us. So it's very moving, and it's become a kind of anthem for a lot of people in the world. It's a song that expresses our longing for a world where we all take care of each other.
Well, listen, thanks so much for being with us this evening, Jamie, and continued enjoyment of your father's work, I'm sure, in the years to come. Let's finish with Somewhere from the original soundtrack. 60 years old is West Side Story. 60 years old yesterday, and here is Somewhere.
There's a place for us. Somewhere a place for us, peace and quiet and open air wait for us somewhere.
Somewhere from West Side Story. Natalie Wood playing the part, but Marnie Nixon doing the singer, doing the singing for her, and it was Jim Bryant as Richard Bamer, who was playing the part of Tony. Huge thanks to Jimmy Bernstein for joining us. 60 years old, West Side Story, released into cinemas yesterday in 1961. Jamie's book, Famous Father Girl, is published by Harper. And the new Steven Spielberg West Side Story will be released in December. And, well, according to Jamie Bernstein, we'll be delighted to see it when it comes. In late 1998, then-President Bill Clinton became the first US president in over a century to be impeached in a case that stemmed from a sexual harassment lawsuit filed by civil servant Paula Jones and his affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky, among other things. Now showrunner Ryan Murphy is retelling the story in the latest installment of his American Crime Story anthology series, following on from The People vs. O.J. Simpson in 2016 and the assassination of Gianni Versace in 2018. Lise Hand has been watching Impeachment, and she joins me now. I suppose the fact that it's an American crime story kind of tells us what Ryan Murphy thinks about the actions of Bill Clinton.
Well, absolutely. It's one of those stories that obviously anyone who was around at the time will vividly remember the absolute and utter furore that broke around this particular affair and how it just went on and on. And in a way, it's kind of, I think, Ryan Murphy, it's almost like a sort of a double crime. He's obviously looking back at the actual events surrounding the impeachment itself and the fact that President Clinton was impeached for perjury and obstruction of justice. But it's also on another level looking at the crime committed against Monica Lewinsky, you know, through the kind of looking back through the lens of a very different place where we are now, and, you know, how she was absolutely vilified and pilloried and became the butt of late night talk shows. And she just, you know, that became her life. She became that woman. So, you know, it's sort of looking at the whole story back, you know, sort of through those two different prisms, I think.
And also, I think the Monica Lewinsky, now I've only seen episode one, I think you've seen more of it than I have for sure. There's more to it than the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton side of things. We have to talk about Linda Tripp and we have to talk about Paula Jones. They're vital to how the series is set up at any rate.
Oh, absolutely, Sean. I mean, this is a story, and, you know, we are seeing more of this and it's really interesting. This is a story told through really through the experiences of women involved in the story. And, it, you know, alongside Monica Lewinsky, it is also the story of Paula Jones and also the story of Linda Tripp, particularly Linda Tripp, who absolutely dominates. I mean, you will have seen episode one. I mean, she absolutely dominates
does, yes.
it. And it's she's played by Sarah Paulson, who also appeared in the O.J. Simpson series as well as Marcia Clark. But she's absolutely outstanding in this. And, you know, the role itself is really interesting because she has to kind of tread that line between, you know, garnering a little bit of sympathy so she isn't a total cartoon villain.
Yeah.
But at the same time, being an utterly unlikable, you know, toxic, resentful person. I mean, you know, really just not a good person at all. And the sort of dynamics of the relationship between herself and Monica Lewinsky is, you know, is just such a betrayal. I mean, absolute betrayal.
Yeah, because at one level, Linda Tripp took Monica Lewinsky under her wing, if you like, initially. But then she wanted to write a book about what she saw in the White House. And it was, to what extent did she sell her up the Swanee at a later stage? I suppose that's the story that has to be told. But let's listen to a clip, Lise, from that first episode, and it's where Monica Lewinsky, played by Beanie Feldstein, meets up with Linda Tripp, played by Sarah Paulson. As you said, they meet for the first time after Monica is transferred from the White House.
Where were you when you were there?
My last stop was the counsel's office. We touched everything at a very high level. I was the last person to see Vince Foster alive.
Oh, wow.
Before that, during Bush, I was on a desk right outside the Oval. Why was I sent to the counsel's office? Well, back in 93, I was very trim. I have reason to believe that Hillary didn't want me near the president, if you know what I mean. Of course, nothing was worse than the day I was sent here, stabbed in the back by a fair-weather friend. I won't say more.
Sounds awful.
It was. It was. Loyalty is very important to me.
Fair-weather or not, I miss having friends in Washington. Most of my intern class left town when they weren't hired, and D.C. gets lonely fast.
Well, now you and I can be miserable together. Although, I have to say, you're such a knockout. I just assumed you'd be dating some big D.C. player. What?
I'm not dating.
Why not?
I'm kind of in something.
And yet you feel lonely.
Yes, affirmative.
Well, that's no good. Tell me about him.
It's just he's unavailable.
Someone long distance. Someone from work. Someone important. Is that why they sent you here?
Oh, try not answering those questions. The silence is deafening. Linda Tripp, played by Sarah Paulson, and Beanie Feldstein there as Monica Lewinsky. And from the opening episode, in fact, of Impeachment, American Crime Story, which is coming to the BBC, and Lee's Hand has been watching it for us. You mention how Sarah Paulson really gets that balance, and certainly you feel sympathy for her at the end of episode one. She's been shafted by previously. How much is this series actually as much about power as it is about sex?
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely all about power. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it is the currency which Washington, D.C. runs on. And I mean, I think that clip portrays that brilliantly. Mm. It's knowledge is power. That's the first step to power, is just knowing everything and having the inside track. And she's just, you could hear there that, you know, Linda Tripp was like a kind of, you know, a shark after its prey, just suddenly sensing that there was something there, and then just ferreting it out until she got to the point where she could use it as leverage. And it is, you know, this whole thing was a power struggle. In a way, I suppose, really, this entire affair really probably sowed the seeds to a huge amount of the kind of the red-blue divide that really sundered during the presidency of Bill Clinton, and just has gotten wider. And it is as much a struggle to bring down the Clintons by any means necessary. And people like Paula Jones and people like Monica Lewinsky were used to this end.
Yeah, because you would have to say Linda Tripp, she didn't like very much about what was going on in the White House, particularly the fact that there were pizza nights and this kind of dressed down casual type of thing, and Hillary using the staff loo. She was not happy about that at all.
No, she really wasn't, which would, you know, indicate that, you know, it was an animosity that ran deep.
Yeah.
And it was also, I think, as well, in that particular scene, I mean, one of the things that seemed to have driven Linda Tripp was the kind of need to feel important and to be recognised and to have a place in, you know, up somewhere on high up the greasy pole of Washington politics. And the fact that, you know, Hillary Clinton used the bathroom, basically just sort of politely nodded at her, but obviously hadn't a clue who she was and cared less, you know, rankled with her and made her kind of aware of her own sort of lack of importance. And, you know, if you want to get ahead in Washington, D.C., it's who you know and, you know, how close to the Oval Office you sit.
Yeah, and there's the several scenes where she's kind of almost reciting her CV at people. Here's what I've done in the past. Here are the people I know. And you kind of feel, well, if you're having to say it out loud like that, you're probably not well connected enough. Let's, however, get to the real meat of the matter here. Beanie Feldstein meeting Clive Owen as Bill Clinton for the first time late in the evening in the West Wing.
Didn't mean to catch you off guard.
Mr. President, sorry, I was just...
You don't have to apologize for doing your job. I'm Bill.
I know. I'm Monica.
I like your sweater, Monica.
Thank you. I guess I should head back.
Well, you can come in here for a second if you want. I'm just kind of hiding out. So what do you make of these guys shutting down the government like this?
So crazy.
You know, they think because I took a licking in the midterms, they can get me to cut health care for old folks. Well, they got me wrong, so here we are.
Thank you.
Of course, between us, it's kind of nice having fewer people around here bugging me.
All the interns can't believe we get to work in the West Wing.
Oh, my first time here. I'll never forget it. High school kid on a boys' nation trip. I got to shake John Kennedy's hand. It's a long way from Arkansas. How about you? Where'd you come from?
Oh, L.A. Los Angeles, California.
You're far from home, too. Where you living?
Out here, in the Watergate.
Whoa, high on the hog.
No, my mom, she's actually moving to New York soon, so we're just staying, living in a condo. Sorry, I'm so nervous. I have a huge crush on you.
Beanie Feldstein as Monica Lewinsky, Clive Owen as Bill Clinton in a scene from Impeachment, American Crime Story. Lee's Hand, Is there a way that Clive Owen could have played that scene that wasn't creepy McCreepville?
Not really, no. I mean, you know, the whole point, I suppose, about this, I mean, from the very opening scene of this, I think you're shocked anew at just how young Monica Lewinsky was. You know, the very opening scene where she's sort of wandering, you know, into a mall for a meeting and has no idea of what's just about to break around her. And there again, you get the sort of sense, you know, talking about having a crush on the president.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just her youth. I mean, you know, it is quite interesting because in the years afterwards and so on, you know, when it was, the bones of this were picked over and she talked, you know, about it being a consensual relationship, you know, while it may have been consensual, I mean, it wasn't in any shape, you know, an affair among equals. I mean, and that's sort of the point of it. And again, I mean, no more than Linda Tripp sort of honing in instinctively on her vulnerability when they had that first meeting in the last clip we heard. Again, it's, you know, Bill Clinton, he just kind of latched onto this, you know, uncertain, starstruck girl far from home and started to create that bond, we're both far from home, which was ludicrous. He was sitting in, like, he's the speed of the free world, sitting in the Oval Office. You know, she's a young one from, you know, that got lucky in the job.
However, declaration of interest, Ms. Lewinsky, on this one, she is a producer on the series. So does the story go hard on her? Does it, is she basically given the sympathetic unquestioned role here?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, there's a sense that I think her motivation getting involved in this was it was going to get done anyway. And, you know, at this stage, she had enough clout to kind of say, look, I want to actually, you know, be part of this. And by all accounts, she was quite involved in it and was also put in a few scenes that or insisted on a couple of scenes going in that the writers had left out due to maybe possible sensitivity. So, you know, I mean, let's face it. I mean, what her dignity was stripped bare years ago. I mean, what has she got to lose from telling the story, with sort of no holds barred, all kind of warts exposed, all this, you know, because, you know, she's been there. She's been to hell and back already. So what more, you know?
10 seconds on it, Lise. You were you were working as a journalist in Washington in the late 1990s. So is this series true to the time, to the Washington that you knew? And are you going to watch the rest of it? And should we all be watching it?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally worth watching. And, you know, it's sort of gripping, uncomfortable, fascinating. I mean, I was in Washington around that time. And I remember sitting in a bar with a bunch of journalists during Bill Clinton's State of the Union address in January 1998, after the scandal had just broken open. And I remember just sort of talking to the journalists and just being sort of saying, you are not governing. Like, the US has literally ground to a halt. And you're just this sort of prurience and this this sort of, you know, fascination with all the gory details and, you know, all these guys. I mean, the whole thing was just sleazy from start to finish. It really was.
All right. Well, I have to watch the rest of it now for sure. Lise, thanks for being with us. Seeing Lise Hand talking to us about impeachment. American Crime Story starts on BBC Two tonight, 9 p.m. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Crop's Last Tape is one of Samuel Beckett's best-loved plays, first produced in 1958 at London's Royal Court Theatre. It's a remarkable layered portrait of a writer on his 69th birthday, looking back over his life, listening to tape recordings of himself aged 39 and then a younger self again, as well as listening to those recordings. Crap's 69th birthday celebrations also involve eating a banana. Directed by Jeff Gould, the production opens tonight at the Everyman Theatre in Cork and sees Dennis Conway playing this iconic role. Dennis joins me now, just ahead of opening night. In fact, Dennis, are there opening night nerves? Do they still exist?
Oh, God, yes, Sean. I think the older we get, the worse they get, to be honest with you. Because when you're business long enough, you know how many things can actually go wrong.
So you have more to worry about. Although you have had, you've had a chance of playing the play in front of an audience already.
Yes, we did this on Saturday night in Letterkenny. A small crowd, I mean, there's COVID restrictions and all that stuff. And hard to judge how it went because it was such a small group of people. But look, we got through it and we were happy with it and we've worked on it since. So it's even better now, I hope. So that's where we're at.
How do you describe a crap situation in this particular birthday celebration of his?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're very much, Jeff is very much the kind of director who obeys what's written by the writer in terms of stage directions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Beckett describes Crap as a weirish old man with a white face, a purple nose, disordered grey hair, and a very large pair of pointy, dirty white boots. And then the first thing he has him do, as you said in your introduction, was he has him eat a banana. So he's a clown. Now, clowns are real people too. So we're playing Crap as a clown who, I suppose you could say he's practicing and it's not working out very well, a bit like the writer. He hasn't sold much. So it's his birthday, we think, and every birthday he plays. He records himself, but before he records himself, he needs copious amounts of drink to get the Dutch courage up to do it. And he also listens back to an old recording of himself. I suspect he listens back to this particular one because he has a kind of a nostalgic view that this is how his life could have been if he had made those choices. But he decided to be a writer and everything that follows that. So that's kind of the take on it, really.
Did you have the foresight, aged 39, to make a recording on the off chance that you might be doing this play later on?
Oh, I remember when I was 39, Sean, and we all spoke about it, possibly including yourself. And, of course, never got around to it. And to be honest, I'm glad I didn't, because I wasn't ready at 39 to play a 39-year-old. I'm somewhere in between the two, a bit closer to the 69 than the 39. But, you know, your voice doesn't change, just deepens. And I think your understanding of the world at 50, say, is better than your understanding of the world at 39. And your commentary on the 39-year-old is probably wiser at 50. So I don't have any regrets. I mean, I know David Kelly long ago did it, and he actually recorded himself, I think, at 39 and then did it when he was actually 69. And he was, of course, brilliant. No, my take on it is my take with Jeff's, and, you know, we're happy with what we've done. The biggest worry for me, to be honest, Sean, was that aspect of it.
Yeah.
How do you make the tape live? Because old Crap listens to the tape along with the audience, and it has to be alive. And I put a lot of work into learning it and then hoping that that would give it a color, which you wouldn't have if I just read it, for example.
Yeah.
So we're happy with that. And actually, I've grown to kind of go, I know it's, you know, you're listening to yourself. It's very hard. It's like looking at yourself on TV. You're going, oh, God, I'm dreadful. And I'm very fat. you know, whereas I kind of got used to it now and going, I know it's OK, actually. It's OK. So I've learned to trust it. And Jeff is a great director in that way. Just trust it, like trust it.
I suppose
and
the fact
I've kind of.
Yeah, I suppose the fact, though, that you did actually learn the 39-year-old part of the recording and then record it as if you were that 39-year-old person, it kind of gives you that sense of looking back. But I'm interested in this clown idea that you have.
Yeah.
Obviously, those stage directions, the eating of the banana and the costume and hair and white face and purple nose, etc., has suggested to you. I mean, many productions that I remember seeing of this play, in my mind, I see Crap seated a lot of the time, switching and turning on and off the recording.
Yeah.
Whereas what you're talking about here in this clown situation, how physical a performance is it as a result of that aspect?
Not particularly. It's physical at the beginning, but I mean, all the productions are physical at the beginning because of the banana stuff. But I think what Beckett was doing is that if you're going to sit and listen, I mean, there is some movement, but there's not a lot. If you're going to sit and listen to a tape, every reaction you have, like the raising of an eyebrow or a tush or whatever, with a clown face on it, reads much larger. So I think that's what he was at as well. So there's a lot of physical reaction in the face to what's said on the tape. And actually, a lot of my job at the moment and Jeff's job is to pare that back, to be honest, because the tape itself works without much of a commentary. But every now and again, you have to make a commentary and he goes off to drink and he comes back and he gets a dictionary, and he comes back and he goes, gets a ledger and he comes back. So there's quite a bit of movement. And it's 50 minutes long and it feels to me about like about 20, and hopefully to the audience, something similar. It's short. It's a short piece. Beautiful piece, though. Beautiful writing.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people, it is one of the most popular of his plays. It is up there with Waiting for Godot and Endgame. It kind of sits in that kind of trilogy of his, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
In terms of Beckett's work, Jeff Gould, Jeff actually saw you in another Beckett one-man show that you had done. Tell us about that show and what Jeff, what it's kind of sparked off a conversation, I'm guessing, between you.
It certainly did. Now, Jeff and I have worked together a number of times before. We know each other very well. He directed me in Making History way back. I did a one-man Beckett called End of Day with Conall Morrison. And it was the one that Jack McGowran did for RTE back in the day. And Jack McGowran had the rights for it, actually.
Yeah.
And it was bits and pieces of the prose, the poetry, and the plays. And as Edward Beckett said afterwards, he loved it and everything. He said, it's a brilliant introduction to Beckett for new people, but he feels that Beckett is so well known now that there's no need for that kind of stuff. So he asked people to do Beckett as written. So anyway, I went down to the West Cork fit up with that. Jeff said, God, I've always wanted to do Crap's Last Tape and I'd like to do it with you. Because Jeff has been studying, he's done a master's in UCC on stuff like this and everything. He loved that show. And he loved the stillness in it and stuff like that. And he thought, God, Dennis could do that. So that's basically how it came about. So he asked me to do it and I was delighted to be asked and to do it.
You talked there about Edward Beckett speaking about this idea that End of Day was in some ways a kind of a primer for Beckett's work for a reader. He was speaking. What about as an actor? What kind of a primer was it for you playing in End of Day and now going to Crap's Last Tape?
Well, it was brilliant. I'll tell you why, Sean, because sometimes things are academized to death in a sense that you start to become intimidated, a bit like Joyce's Ulysses or something like that, you know? And you forget that if you actually just go, no, I'm intelligent enough to read it, I remember reading Ulysses eventually and laughing out loud for weeks because it takes that long to read it. And then going, God, this is quite accessible, not everywhere, but in places. And then, so when I did End of Day with Beckett, I went in like with intrepidation and I found that there was an emotional core and I would base my acting on the truth of what the character is feeling and then try and portray that honestly for the writer to the audience. And sometimes you feel with Beckett that it's cold, but actually I don't think it is. I think it's really, really funny and I think it's really, really profound. And the job of the actor for me, I think, is to just feel it and inhabit the character and don't apologize for any emotion that you feel, you know? So that would be my take. Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose that's in many ways what you're hoping the audience will get from tonight's performance. And indeed, you're doing several performances around the country. You're on a bit of a tour.
Yes, we are. So it's kind of higgledy-piggledy because I'm doing a TV thing at the moment and it's trying to fit in between all those dates and blah, blah, blah. Like it's a feast or a famine, nothing for 2 years and now this. So we're actually this week. So we're in Cork this week, today, tonight and tomorrow. And then we're in Skibbereen on Friday. And the next week we're in the Town Hall in Galway and Dunleary towards the end of the week, Thursday and Friday and then so on.
Best of luck with it all, and I better let you get back into the preparations for this evening's performance. Thanks for being with us, Dennis.
Appreciate it, Sean. Thank you very much. God bless.
Dennis Conway there, and literally about to make his way out onto the stage of the Everyman Theatre in Cork for tonight's performance of Crap's Last Tape. He'll be there again tomorrow night at 8 p.m. and then various venues around the country. EverymanCork.com for full details. But that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gard Duffy was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.